Okay, so here we are. We made it another week. Last week we were talking about impermanence and death. So how fortunate we are, we're still here. We'll start off the sessions like we usually do, with a little bit of breathing meditation. And we'll do the visualization, the different recitations, and then go into the text. Okay, so although I won't be giving a lot of detail about the visualization or about how to think during the recitations, I'm really counting on you to having reviewed, you know, what was taught at the beginning. Reviewing what was taught at the beginning about how to think during these recitations, how to do the visualization. And also, since many of these practices, like the seven-line prayer, the mandala offering, and so on, they're taught in, you know, they're covered in many Dharma books. And on my website, you know, there's much discussion of these kinds of things. And some of you were here for Dogmala's teaching last weekend, and in the King of Prayers, the first couple of pages are a long version of the seven-limb prayer. Yeah, so she also explained how to think about that. So, you know, I'm counting on you bringing in what you've studied and learned outside of the class or by reviewing the class. Okay? You're all looking like me. Okay. Okay, so let's start with calming our mind, doing a little bit of breathing meditation, and then we'll go into the visualization of the Buddha. Space in front of you. Visualize the Buddha surrounded by all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, Dakas, Dakinis, and Dharma protectors. So we'll pause here for a little bit so you can describe the visualization to yourself and do the visualization as you're describing it to yourself. And remember that everything in the visualization is made of light. Remember also to describe how the Buddha is looking at you with compassion and acceptance, and really take that in. And then imagine yourself surrounded by all the sentient beings. You can put your mother on your left side, your father on your right side, and all the other sentient beings surrounding you. And maybe the people that you're having some problem with, put them right in front of you so that to see the Buddha, you also have to look at them. And then as we do the recitations, think that you're leading all the sentient beings and taking refuge, generating four immeasurables, and so on. And really think about the meaning of what you're saying. And especially as we recite the refuge verse, think of light coming from the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in the space in front of you, filling you, and it's and filling all the sentient beings around you too. And think that it really is purifying any negative karma you created with your spiritual mentors or with the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, and then bringing all their blessings and inspirations and realizations into you. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings.
May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger.
Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my obstructive actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please rename until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great awakening.
This ground anointed with perfume, flowers to bloom now Meru, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you. Objects of attachment, aversion, and ignorance, friends, enemies, and strangers, my body, wealth, and enjoyments, I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous attitudes.
Idam Guru Rana Mandala Kambiryataya. Replica of the Buddha, manifest from the Buddha in front of you and comes and sits in the crown of your head, facing the same way as you do. And as we make requests to the merit field, we think that the Buddha is also helping us to make the request. Glorious and precious Red Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise beings vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make request.
That there's a Buddha on the crown of the heads of all the other beings around you. And as we say the mantra, think that light and nectar is coming
from the Buddha into you. First, white light and nectar, purifying negativities and obstacles. And then golden light and nectar, bringing the realizations and the inspiration. Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Soon be destroyed. Death is certain to occur. No inner or outer circumstance can prevent it. I cannot add on to my lifespan, which in fact shortens unceasingly moment by moment. I am sure to die without having had the time to practice the teachings while alive. Not only do I have to die, but the time of my death is uncertain, because the lifespan of sentient beings in our world is uncertain. The causes of death are numerous, and those of life are few. And our bodies are as fragile as water bubbles. So the time of our death is uncertain. At the time of death, everything but the Dharma teaching is useless. No matter how great the affection and love that our circle of dear ones has for us, we cannot take a single one of those people with us. No matter how large a collection of lovely possessions I have, or how much money I have, I cannot bring even the tiniest portion of it with me. I must even be separated from the very flesh and bones, this body I was born with. Therefore, what purpose does attachment to the good things of this life serve? Death is sure to come, but it is unsure when it will occur. Since I run the risk of dying this very day, truly I must do something to prepare for my death. By way of preparation, may I practice the Dharma teachings purely, free of attachment to any of the excellent things in this life. Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do this. In response to your request, to the Guru Buddha, five-colored light and nectar stream from all parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. The light and nectar absorb into your mind and body and into those of all the sentient beings around you. Purifying all negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time. And especially purifying all illnesses, interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with practicing the teachings purely, free of attachment to the happiness of only this life. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. All your good qualities, lifespan, merit, intelligence, and so forth, expand and increase. And think in particular that a superior realization of the ability to practice the Dharma purely, free of attachment to the happiness of this life, that realization has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind stream of all the sentient beings around you. So we've been talking about, you talked about how to rely on a spiritual mentor as a way of rooting ourselves in the path, how to create a good relationship with our spiritual mentors. And then we talked about our precious human life, the states, unfortunate states that we're free from at present, the beneficial conditions that we have, and what kind of purpose and meaning this very rare to attain human life, precious human life, gives us, you know, in terms of preparing for future lives, attaining liberation, even full awakening, and how difficult it is to have this kind of situation again, because it's so hard to create the karma, all the different karmic causes that are required to have the 18 conditions of a precious human life. Difficult to create those causes. And, you know, we can see numerically very few human beings compared to other life forms, and that actually very few human beings have a precious human life. Yeah. So it's quite difficult to have this possibility. And so therefore it's really important to make our life meaningful while we can, and not kind of waste time. So the next meditation, the one on impermanence and death, is given to help accentuate that point. That, you know, because when we meditated on precious human life, we come out feeling how fortunate we are to have the opportunity that we do. But then we can start taking that opportunity for granted. Oh yeah, I've been alive all this time, haven't died yet. Death happens later, it happens to other people. I'll have some warning before it happens. You know, there's plenty of time. I can kind of have a good time and then practice the Dharma, you know, when I'm old. And so this meditation on death shows us that that is an incorrect way of thinking. Okay? Because death is definite. Its time of death is indefinite. Okay? So last time we talked about the six disadvantages of not remembering impermanence and death. And among that we went into depth about the eight worldly concerns, and how we spend a great deal of our time just running around in circles involved in the happiness of only this life, because the appearance of this life is so vivid to us. And we feel like a concrete, real person. We think everything around us is concrete and real and stable and, you know, pretty permanent. And so, you know, we just keep thinking, well, how can I get the most pleasure? That's what life is about. But when we think about the disadvantages of not remembering death and impermanence, we realize that, no, life isn't about eating, drinking, and being merry, and it isn't about, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There's, you know, something else going on here. And if we do remember death and impermanence, and we do remember the Dharma and the purpose and meaning of our life, then our lives can be very highly meaningful. And our death can also be very meaningful. So much so that they say that even a lower level practitioner will die without fear, which is nice. The middle level practitioner is happy, and with that in their mind is peaceful and has no regret. Also able, you know, be nice to die without regret, huh? And then for a very advanced practitioner, they say death is like going on a picnic. They have a really good time. Okay, so that depends on how we live our lives. Yeah. It's not how much we pray, oh Buddha, Buddha, may I have a good death. It's how much we practice during our lives and familiarize ourselves with the Dharma so that when death comes, we can keep our mind steady, yeah, and keep our mind in the Dharma. So now we're going to go into what is commonly called the 9-point death meditation. So this meditation has three main roots, or three main subsections, and each of those subsections has 3 points plus a conclusion. Okay, so let me just list the three main sections, okay? First one is death is definite. Second is the time of death is indefinite. And third is that at the time of death, only the Dharma matters. Okay, so let's go back to the first one, that death is definite. Then there's 3 points under there. First is that everybody's got to die. And there's no circumstance that can turn death back. Okay? So everybody's born, who's born, no matter what social ranking they have, what socioeconomic class they belong to, how much wealth they have, whether they're religious figures or powerful political figures or whoever it is, everybody dies and there's no way around it. And so it's very helpful to really consider that and think about that deeply. And just even starting to think about the people that you really care about, the people you're close to. You know, maybe your parents or your siblings or, you know, partners or very dear friends or whoever. And think that those people are going to die. And there's no way that they can avoid death. And there's no way we can avoid death. That every single one of us in this room right now is going to die. And probably 100 years from now, none of us will be here. Okay, the second point under that is that our lifespan can't be extended when it's time to die. You know? So when the time of death is there, when our karmic lifespan is exhausted, there's no choice. We die. That's it. You can't file a petition to the government to extend your life. Any whining and complaining does absolutely no good. You know, when the time of death is there, there's no way around it to extend the lifespan. Nowhere. We can't go anywhere else in the universe. You can go to the moon. You can go out of space, you can anything. There's no place to go to avoid death. And then the third point into that is that we will die even if we haven't had the time to practice the Dharma. Okay? So they often here tell the story of like the typical human life. The first 20 years, this is based on a 60-year lifespan. The first 20 years we're kids, so we're playing and we're running around having a good time and getting an education, right? Is that what you did your first 20 years? Running around, having a good time, as much of a good time you can have, and getting your education, but that's basically what we did during those first 20 years. Second 20 years, yeah, you find a partner, you settle down, you have a family, you go to work, you have a job, you earn money, okay, and you help your family to grow and you live the family life. Right? Yeah. Then, by that time you're 40 years old. then the last 20 years, okay, actually, you know, it might be better for us in dividing it into periods of 25 and 25. First 25, your education, play, have a good time. The next 25 until you're 50, or maybe even 55, you're working at a job, raising your family, getting a lot of money, preparing for your retirement, increasing your stature in society, the kind of things people do between 25 and 55. Then, around 55, 60, 65, you retire, and you think, then I'll practice the Dharma. Yeah, practice the Dharma that last period of my life. But by that time, we're full of aches and pains. Our health is declining. Yeah, we're still caught up in our career. Now we have grandchildren to take care of. And so actually, that time goes by pretty quickly too. And even though we always have in our mind, I will practice the Dharma, we never get the time to because we're always busy with things of only this life. True or not true? True? When you look around, look at your parents' life, or look at, older siblings or family friends or whoever, this is kind of it. And then death comes without having had the time to practice, and at that time there's nothing you can do. You can't say, excuse me, I need some more time, or I wasn't planning on dying at age 75. I was planning on dying at age 275. That doesn't work at that time. Okay? So what we conclude from meditating on these three points that are under the topic of death is definite is that we must practice the Dharma. That practicing the Dharma is really important, because otherwise we go through our whole life, we die, we have no virtue, no good karma, no, internal transformation to take with us. Okay, then the second big heading is that the time of death is uncertain. So, for the first point under that is that in general, there's no certainty of lifespan on our planet. Is there? People die at all sorts of ages. It's very interesting sometimes, go to a cemetery or a columbarium and look at the dates of the people, on the stones. And people die at all ages. It's not like we think, I'm going to die sometime in the future, way when I'm old. There's many people who have died who have been younger than us. Hmm? Do you all know some people who younger than you who are dead? Yeah, who never made it to your age, or who never made it even to be 20. So there's no certainty. Death can happen at any time. And then second under that is that there's many causes of death and very few of remaining alive. Okay. So we feel like, everything around us supports our life. Yeah, and we have so many enjoyments and so many things that support our life. But in actual fact, when you think about it, there's many causes of death. And we have to work really hard to stay alive. If we did nothing, we would die. Yeah. If we did nothing, you know, didn't go look for food or protect our body or whatever, we would die. We have to do so much to stay alive. Yeah? You have to go out and get a job, you have to do this and that, and, you know, buy the food and cook the food and eat it and wash the dishes and protect yourself from being too hot or being too cold, all these things that can cause death, you know. It's actually very easy to die, just don't do anything whatsoever. And yet to stay alive, we have to do so much. And then also under this is that even the things that help us stay alive and help us to have a good life can also be the cause of death. Yeah, think of the people in the Malaysia flight, you know, shot down over Ukraine. Most of them were going on holiday or to see friends or relatives, going to conferences, always, you know, involved in the things of this life, always in the middle of doing something. Yeah, it's not like you complete everything in your life and then you say, okay, now I can die. I mean, death always comes when you're in the middle of doing something. Yeah. How many people even today got in the car in the morning, their minds, you know, full of plans, everything they were going to do, who they were going to see, what was going to happen, and then they got in a car accident? Yeah, for sure that happened today. It happens every day in our country. Yeah. And then here is, you know, I've got to tell you the story of how my father died, because it's a perfect example of how the causes of life become the causes of death. So, next Tuesday, it'll be 7 weeks on that day. It was the eve of my father's 93rd birthday. Yeah, so he's going to be 93 on June 25, and on June 24, my sister and her kids and some other friends came over to the house to celebrate Dad's birthday, and also my nephew's birthday. Their birthdays were pretty close in time. And they made Dad's favorite food. My sister wrote me an email the day before. She said, we're going to have such a good time celebrating Dad's birthday. He's going to be really happy. So they did a barbecue. They gave Dad some steak. He loves steak. He cut a piece of steak, put it in his mouth, choked, and within 3.5 minutes, was gone. Yeah? He forgot to chew it. He didn't have a gag response. He, you know, just put that in his mouth, stopped breathing, turned blue, fell off the chair. They tried to do Heimlich's. They couldn't get the meat out. And he was dead, like that. By the time 911 got there, you know, his vitals were completely flat. And so here was, you know, he was supposed to be having a good time celebrating his birthday, and the meat was supposed to nourish his body and keep him alive. And it became the cause of death. Yeah. And so it's just like that. Just like that. You know, when you hear so many stories of how people died, I mean, there's so many different ways to die. And sometimes, you know, you die while you're trying to have a good time. You know, you're going, remember that accident with all the Sherpas on Mount Everest not long ago? You know, doing their work, doing their career work, avalanche, bang, gone. Okay? You know, how many people are doing all sorts of different things? Trying to have a good time, trying to support their family, whatever, and they die in the middle of doing it. Yeah? So there's many causes of death, few of staying alive. And then in addition, our body is actually extremely fragile. We think our body's very strong. Especially when you're in teens and 20s, you think you're invincible. I'm never going to get a serious disease. I'm never going to get injured. I'm never going to die. You know, there's this feeling of invincibility, like my body is like Superman or something. But even Superman had that weak spot, remember? So, you know, when we look at it, I mean, our body is actually quite fragile. Little tiny microscopic viruses that we can't even see can kill us. Yeah. Little pieces of metal, yeah, tiny pieces of metal can kill us. Yeah. Small things that we're exposed to or, you know, whatever can kill us. I mean, on our skin, so easily scratched, you know, things can get inside. Yeah, there's that, how do you say it, Ebola or Ebola? Ebola? Yeah, the epidemic going around now in Africa, so easy, you know. You can just touch things that are contaminated and then touch your eyes or your mouth or whatever and get the disease. So there's many things like that. So actually we shouldn't feel like we're invincible. That's kind of a wrong view, isn't it? Okay, so when we meditate on these three points that show that the time of death is indefinite, okay, then the conclusion we draw from it is not only that I must practice Dharma, but I must practice Dharma now. So, you know, it's no use mañana en la mañana because tomorrow morning may not come, okay? Have to start now, have to do it now, okay? And then the third broad point is that nothing can help at the time of death except the Dharma. That's the only thing that can help at the time of death. Okay, so at the time we die, can any of our possessions prevent us from dying? You could have millions in the bank account. Can any of it prevent your death? Yeah. None of it can prevent your death. And at the time of death, we have to separate from all those possessions, all of that money. We spent our whole life working so hard to get possessions and money, yeah, creating all sorts of karma, probably a lot of it non-virtuous, so that we can get the money, get the possessions, you know, because we have attachment for it, we get angry at people who, you know, threaten our getting it and so on. But at the time of death, none of those possessions, none of that money comes with us. But the karma we created to procure and protect it does come with us. Yeah. And that karma will ripen in terms of what kind of life we're born as, what we experience even when we're born later as a human being, our habitual behavior, our environment. So those kinds of things are influenced by our previous actions. Yeah. But none of the possessions go with. And you work so hard to get them all, you leave them behind, and then your family fights over who's going to get them. And this is true, isn't it? Very true. Okay, then, so we think, okay, my possessions can't do it for me. But the people I love, they can save me from dying. Yeah, we've been together so long, we love each other so much, we trust each other so much, we're inseparable, they can prevent me from dying. Is that true? Can any other human being prevent you from dying? Oh, maybe the doctor can. No. Yeah. And so at the time of death, all the people we care about, all the people we're close to, that we spent so much time with, that we had so many wonderful experiences with, we separate from at the time of death. There's no choice. You know? Our mind stream goes on alone. Those people stay here. They can be surrounding us at the time we're dying, holding our hand, sobbing and crying, "I love you, don't leave me." And that can't prevent you from dying. And how's it going to make you feel if they're around your deathbed, sobbing and clinging onto you and saying, "Don't leave me"? I think that would be awful. Yeah? All these people who want to die surrounded by their relatives? Last year, actually it was in the middle of EML, wasn't it?
A year ago.
When Bill was dying, yeah. So last year, in the middle of EML, a very good friend, student, he was dying, and so in California. So I checked with the people in EML. They were fine with me going down and helping him. Usually I don't do this. This was a special kind of thing. And I went down, and he was in Stanford Hospital. He had had excellent care. But he had had a lung transplant some months back, and it didn't work so well. He was in and out of the hospital, and finally they said, "You know, your body's rejecting this. There's nothing we can do." And so his wife was there, his two adult children were there, and his best friend were there, and I was there. And it was a situation where the medical staff took the vent out of his mouth, and that was it. And so I was there, you know, kind of saying mantra, giving him instructions and all these things. And you know, his family and friends were so overwhelmed with their own distress that at that time, I mean, there was nothing they could do to help him. I mean, it was so clear to me then that when you're attached to somebody, you can't help them when they die because your own mind is so overwhelmed by the thought of separating from the person that you're so attached to that you can't give them any Dharma instructions. You can't think about that at that very time. You know, after he stopped breathing, then, you know, we all did some recitations and things together. So I said, "Okay, now we're going to sit and do this." And that put their mind in the Dharma somewhat. But don't think that your dear ones can prevent you from death, or, you know, can even really help you much, because they will be so distressed that that's what they'll be dealing with. And then last, you know, even our body that we've never been separated from since the day we were born, that also becomes the biggest traitor at the time of death. You know, because our consciousness leaves the body. So this body that we have taken such good care of, that we have pampered, that we have worried about, that we have put so much time and energy into, keeping it healthy, making it attractive, giving it pleasure, then this body also just deserts us at the time of death. And we're left really just with the karma from having all the things that we've done to give this body pleasure and to protect it. So you might think, oh, well, that's not very much. Yeah, I don't think about my body very much. Think again. Think again. Yeah? We ate today. Were you a little picky about what you ate? And even when you, you know, have a mouthful, putting together exactly the right combination of different foods, you know, on your fork or spoon for each mouthful so that you can get the optimum amount of pleasure from that bite? Do you do that? Or do you just blindly stick your fork in? No, we don't do that and have it be potluck, stick and eat. No, we take, I'm going to have, you know, we stir it around. I'm going to take a little of this, a little of that, just the right amount, put it all together, have the good take its stuff on the bottom so it hits your taste buds first, and then zoom, you know? And we do this with every mouthful. Yeah? Because we want to give our body optimum pleasure. Okay? Then when, you know, we lie down to sleep, our bed. Yeah. Can you sleep on this floor here? This carpeting doesn't even have a pad under it. We don't even like to walk on it. It's hard. Can you? And if your bedroom's downstairs and somebody's walking on it, it disturbs you. Yeah. I need to sleep and somebody's walking upstairs. Clunk, clunk, they sound like an elephant. My body can't get to sleep. And my bed is too soft. My back hurts. It's too hard. You know, I can't sleep. It's, you know, the wrong shape. It sags in the middle. And then my blanket's too hot, or I don't have enough blankets, or I don't have my favorite blanket. And the pillow's too high, or the pillow's too low, so my neck hurts. Yeah. And then the alarm clock goes off, and oh, that's such a pain in the neck, you know. And then the cat comes. It's time to feed me. The only cat your time your cat pays attention to you. Yeah. So, you know, our body is constantly uncomfortable, constantly being, you know, uncomfortable. I mean, how often can you be comfortable? Have you sat here in this teaching without moving? No. You're like a bunch of... Yeah? Even during the meditation time when you're supposed to concentrate. Yeah? The body's never satisfied. And then what we have to do to make our body attractive, because God forbid we're not attractive, you know. So... we have to do all these things to make our body attractive. So you have to dye your hair, or if you don't have any, you have to get some hair. Yeah, or, you know, you have to make sure you have hair where you want it, not where you don't want it. Yeah, you have to make sure you bulge where you want to bulge, and you don't bulge where you don't want to bulge, and we usually bulge where we don't want to bulge. You know, so then you have to go to the gym to lose weight, to get your body in the proper shape. You look in the mirror, it's like, I don't look like these models. Yeah, who's going to love me if I don't look like those models? You know, and then you have to do so much, you know, your eyebrows, and dyeing your eyebrows. And the guys have to dye. Their sideburns, you can't have gray sideburns. That looks terrible. Who's going to want to go to bed with a guy with gray sideburns? Really? know, to make this body attractive. You have to go out and get clothes, and they have to fit correctly, and they have to be clean. And then our body, I mean, what is our body? You think our body is some beautiful thing? Yeah? I mean, what comes out? You know, snot comes out here, vomit comes out here, sleep comes out here, earwax comes out here. You know, who knows what comes out in the lower orifices? We don't even want to be around it smells so bad. And, you know, and yet we are so patriotic to our body. You know, my body is so wonderful. It must be clean and comfortable and well taken care of. And the laundry soap, I almost caught myself doing this, you know, complaining because the laundry soap makes the clothes itchy. Speaking of which, have you ever noticed maybe somebody's using too much laundry soap at our laundry? Because our clothes are like really itchy and scratchy afterwards. Nuns, have you noticed that? You've noticed it too. Okay, yeah. So something's happening. It's really kind of, you put your clothes on and you scratch. I want nice, smooth clothes, okay? And then, of course, it's got to be the right color. Yeah. My maroon doesn't match. This maroon doesn't match that maroon. My mother would not approve. You know? And so, you know, how we dress, what we look like, are we wearing the latest style, how we pamper this body, and yet at the time of death, goodbye. Yeah? Mind separates from this body. Body stays here. Then we're even kind of attached to what happens to our body after we die. Yeah? So if I'm somewhere else, they've got to bring my body home. They've got to bathe it, put it out, you know, in a nice coffin, embalm it or put makeup on so I look very beautiful. I remember in college, one of my good friends, her mother died of Hodgkin's. And at the funeral, I heard somebody say, "Oh, I haven't seen her look so good for a long time." Yeah? So, you know, we're concerned what happens to our body. Am I going to look good at my funeral? Yeah? Are they going to bury me properly? I want to be buried here. I don't want to be buried there. Yeah, it was very interesting, you know, when my dad was just being buried, to hear people around saying, "Oh, I don't want to be buried. I don't want to be covered in dirt. Or I don't want to be cremated and burned. Or I don't want to be buried next to that person." Yeah. So, you know, so we're so attached to what happens to our body. You know, I find it so interesting. You know, the plane crash? Then they're trying to get all the different parts of the bodies that, you know, were out in the sun for how many days because they couldn't get there to the site of the crash? And get all those parts of the bodies and do DNA checks. And then return, you know, like the different parts of the bodies to the families so that they could bury them or cremate them or whatever. Yeah? So we're so consumed about this body, and yet, yeah, mind leaves the body, doesn't matter what you look like. Yeah? Thinking, I want to look good at my own funeral. Yeah? Okay? So the point of thinking, you know, that our possessions are of no lasting value and are no help at the time we die. Our friends and relatives and dear ones, no help. You know, similar with our body. No help at the time we die. And yet, all the karma we've created, doing actions motivated by attachment or anger or jealousy or arrogance, you know, in relationship to our possessions, our money, our friends and dear ones and our body, all that karma comes. comes with us. Yeah. And so the point, the conclusion to draw from thinking about that is that not only must I practice Dharma, not only must I practice it purely, not only must I practice it right now, but I must practice it purely without being influenced by attachment to the happiness of this life through gaining comfortable comforts with possessions and friends and relatives in our body. Okay? So when you really do this meditation on impermanence and death regularly, it really changes your priorities. And you do it, you have to make it very personal. Okay? So again, the purpose of this meditation is not to make us have this kind of panicky, freaked out fear of death. It's to help wake us up so that if we're afraid of something, we're afraid of living a meaningless life. We're afraid of not practicing the Dharma and so not being prepared when the time of death comes. Okay? We're afraid of dying with attachment or with anger. Okay? So we want to really practice now and practice purely. A few things that are important along that line are not to hold grudges and to stay on top of our lives and forgive the people we need to forgive and apologize to the people we need to apologize to. Because we don't know when we're going to die and we don't know when they're going to die. And so holding a grudge for a long time, thinking, you know, I'll make up right before they, you know, I die, you may not have that chance. One of the inmates that I've corresponded with in prison, he was one of these people who was, you know, because there was a rash of people convicted of being sexual predators or being pedophiles, you know, because people were having these memories of being abused and then bringing that to court and so on. And the psychologist kind of encouraging people to have memories or solidifying things. Anyway, this was his case. His daughter had had some dream and told the therapist, and then the therapist said, oh yes, you must have been sexually abused by your father, and reported it to the court, and he got convicted, and he said, he told me he never could, you know, abused her, and he never would. Okay, so it was one of those kinds of cases. Anyway, because of that kind of case, his mother was furious with him and, you know, refused to speak to him. So he was in prison. She didn't call, she didn't come and visit, she didn't write, nothing. Okay, he wanted to have some contact with her, but what could he do if she didn't respond? Then, one day, he had been in prison several years, they told him that there was a phone call from his mother. So he went to get it, you know, to talk to her. And she was terminally ill. She had just a few weeks left. And she wanted to make contact with her son and make amends. Yeah. Which I thought was really good that, you know, she wanted to make amends and kind of clear her own conscience and reestablish a relationship with him before she died. But at the same time, I felt that was good. I felt sad because she could have done that years earlier without suffering so much by holding the grudge. At least she had the time to make contact with him. Many people, you know, they die like this, no advance warning. There's no chance to contact somebody and apologize, okay? Or forgive or reestablish the relationship. So I think it's very important in our lives that we don't let resentments build up in our relationships. You know, whenever there's something funny or some funny feeling going on, you know, to as immediately try and resolve it. Sometimes the other person may not be ready to resolve it, but at least in our own minds we apologize. At least in our own minds we forgive, so that inside of us the situation is resolved, even if the other person isn't ready yet. Okay? And so to really make effort to do that. And if we do, then, you know, every night when we go to bed, our conscience is clear, our feelings are clear, we're not taking to sleep any kind of grudges or resentments or bitter feelings or anything like that. And we're also not taking to mind any regret, going to sleep with any regret or any guilt for actions we've done that may have harmed somebody, because we've apologized or we've done purification practices. Okay, so if we can live like that, then it makes our life a lot happier, it makes our death easier, because sometime in the middle of doing that, we're going to go, aren't we? Okay? Then also with this meditation on impermanence and death, in addition to the 9-point death meditation, there's a meditation of imagining your own death. And this can be really useful, really informative to get us to check up what our feelings are and what's going on. And so it can be very useful just, you know, think that you go to the doctor one day and because you aren't feeling well, and they do some tests, and, you know, then they call you in and say, you know, you have whatever disease it is, and, you know, we can give you some chemo, or we can give you some medicine like this or that, but the disease is progressive and we don't know how to cure it. And so really imagine, you know, what that's like to be, imagine sitting in the doctor's office having the doctor tell you that. And what do you feel? And then afterwards, after you leave the doctor's office, what are you going to do? Who are you going to tell? How are you going to tell them? How are they going to react when you tell them? Yeah. And then, knowing that you just have a short time to live, you know, doctors give kind of prognoses, but nobody knows if they're correct or not. Then what are you going to do if they tell you you have a year left, or if they tell you you have 3 months left or 3 weeks left? What are you going to do? Yeah? And to sit and think about that. What am I going to do with that time I have left? And see what comes into your mind. What am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? Are you going to think, I don't want to think about my death, and I'm just going to go out and have a good time? Are you going to think, I need to make contact with all these relatives I haven't seen in so long and, you know, catch up with them? Or I've got to work really hard at work and finish this project so when I die, nobody's inconvenienced at work. You know? Or, you know, what are you thinking? What are you going to do? And where does Dharma fit in there? Yeah. So don't do this as a meditation, you know, being the perfect Dharma practitioner, you know, kind of, so I can be the good girl or the good boy and get the star. But really look into your own mind, how you're feeling and where your mind is likely to go. And really check up. And then ask yourself, you know, because it's not like you're going to be completely healthy until the moment before you die. Your health is going to, you know, diminish during that time. And so if you have some idea that you want to practice the Dharma, what are you going to practice? How are you going to practice? And what are you going to do as you're losing your health? As your body's becoming weaker? Maybe your mind is becoming more confused? Yeah? Maybe you're in a lot of pain. They have to give you some pretty strong drugs. So how are you going to practice then? And then, you know, continue with the meditation and imagine when you're actively dying. And so, you know, do this meditation different times and make it different scenarios. You know, maybe one time you're dying in the hospital. Maybe one time you're dying at home. Maybe one time you're dying alone. Maybe one time you're dying with people around you. You know, make up different scenes. And like, how clear is your mind going to be? What are you going to think about? Is there something that's left undone at the time that you die that's, you know, going to come up and say, wait, I need to talk to this person or do this thing before I die? And what is that? Okay? So it's very good to do this thing of, you know, just imagining your death, making up different scenes and see how your mind thinks about it and ask yourself, you know, what does the Dharma mean to me and what am I, you know, am I even going to think about the Dharma or is my mind going to go somewhere else? And if I think about the Dharma, or if I think the Dharma is going to help me, what am I going to think about? What do I want to have in my mind as my body and mind are losing power and as they're separating? So it's very, very helpful to do this kind of meditation. Be quite good, you know, kind of today, tomorrow, next day. You know, the people who are leading the meditations downstairs to lead the 9-point meditation and then to lead the, you know, in another session, you know, do the one of imagining your death. Very, very useful. And it helps us think, you know, how am I going to prepare myself for my death? Because my death is the one thing I have to do. We go through our lives saying, I have to do this and I have to do that. Actually, we don't have to do any of those things. We choose to do them. The only thing we have to do is die. Okay, so think about this and think, you know, when you do this meditation, then how does it affect how you're living and what you're choosing to do while you're alive? And imagine, you know, sometimes you might imagine, you're dying when you're older and you've had your family and your kids, and what's it going to be like to die then and separate from your family and your kids? And sometimes, you know, when you do it, think that you're going to die now, that you don't feel well, you go to the doctor, run some tests. Or you go for some, you know, you go skiing or you go for something to have a good time and you have an accident. Okay? So quite useful for getting us to think about, well, how, you know, to the extent that I'm able to plan for my death, what am I planning and what am I going to do? And what is really important for me in my life? Considering that at any moment I could die. Okay. So I think we have some time for questions, maybe answers.
My question was children. Mm-hmm. And if you have any advice or ideas, how should one broach the topic of death with children?
How to broach the topic of death with children? I think when kids see animals or bugs who are dying or other family members who die, then they ask questions. So I think at that time, you know, when they ask questions, then answer their questions.
I was just thinking about how well it would go for Dom. What world that we're built for Don
Blackerly. Yeah, it's okay.
It's a great exemplary, great example.
Yeah.
I'd like to dive with.
Yeah. Okay, so Don Blackerly was another inmate that I corresponded with for quite a long time. He was on death row in Oklahoma. His case was so screwy. His last lawyer came out here because she was doing interviews to try and get him clemency. So I was one of the people she interviewed. And she was telling me about the details of the case. And it was so, there are so many unknowns, you know, that we don't know if he really killed the person that he was convicted of killing. He said he didn't, and there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in the case. But they convicted him, and he was on death row. And one person from the Abbey who was living here, his mother lived in Oklahoma, so he went back there to visit. Now, I spoke to him on the phone. Did others of you speak to him on the phone too? Because I know I wound up going to India right before he died. I was in Singapore when they executed him. So you guys were talking to him on the phone. He had a lot on his plate, you know. He had spent many years being totally zoned out on drugs, being totally inconsiderate of other people, doing many things that harmed other people. And at the same time, when his family then didn't want to talk to him, being mad at them for not talking to him. Yeah. So there was a lot of stuff going on. And I was pretty straight with him. And when he whined to me about, you know, his sister not wanting to talk to him, I said, look what you did. Look, you know, look how you're treating her right now. How can you be the kind of person that she would want to talk to? Have you apologized for what you've done? Yeah, I mean, I just hit him totally straight. And he did a lot of really good work as the time for his execution was approaching. So much so, Dumbhill was out there and saw him earlier that day, right?
Yeah, and he also previously went to the refuge.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the actual execution, so there was a person from the Abbey and then this one Geshe from Arkansas who was there too. And Don just, he went in there and he just said, Omani Padme Hum, continuously. And his last words, what did he say? I forget what he said. It was not, I'm innocent, you're killing the wrong person. Something about compassion, that's right. Yeah. And then he just started saying, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum. And they went ahead and executed him the whole time he sang Omani Padme Hum. And even when they wrote it up in the newspaper, you know, the reporter noticed that.
All beings in his heart as it was dying. That's how I remember it. I don't remember the words, I just remember he just had his heart open.
Yeah. Like yeah, really having compassion for all beings at that time. And that was astounding, you know, that somebody who had lived as he had lived was able to concentrate and focus like he was able to at the time he died. But towards the end, he had very, very strong motivation to do that. And he had also come to a point where he really, had let go of a lot of those grudges and resentment and had replaced it with compassion.
His family gave us his ashes so we could put them in Sita Bhakti. So he did reconcile with his family.
Yeah, that's right. He did reconcile with his two sisters before. And they sent us his ashes and we sprinkled them in Sukhavati.
And so many people were making prayers for him.
That's right. Yes, all over the world people were making prayers for him. Quite amazing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
How can we help non-Buddhists during their death?
How to help non-Buddhists? You don't want to know how to help yourself during your death? You want to help non-Buddhists? You talk to them in terms of language and concepts that make sense to them. Yeah, if they're from another religion, use the symbols and words from that religion. If they're of no religion, just talk about kindness, talk about compassion, encourage them to forgive, encourage them to apologize, to remember their virtuous deeds, to go on with loving kindness. There's a section on tuptonchudren.org called Death and Dying, and so if you refer to that, there's a lot of information there about these kinds of things. There was a question that somebody wrote in. I'll see that. So last time they had asked about the when we say, I take refuge until I'm enlightened, you know, what that whole verse, did that include the Bodhisattva vow? So I had responded about that last time. So they're saying now, this person is thinking kind of, okay, so the Bodhisattva vow is a vow through which Bodhisattvas promise to attain Buddhahood to relieve all sentient beings of suffering. But doesn't the attainment of full Buddhahood mean that that Bodhisattva, who is now a Buddha, can no longer explicitly or directly benefit sentient beings in samsara in the future because the Buddha is no longer reborn after his present lifetime ends? Okay, so this idea of the Buddha no longer being reborn, or no longer, or the continuity of the Buddha's mind stream being extinguished after, you know, the end of this life, that is a view from the Pali tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, we say that there is nothing that can stop the continuity of the mind. And so the Buddha's enlightened mind continues as an enlightened mind even after this particular body is shed. Okay? And then there's the question, well, what about the Bodhisattva who, motivated by great compassion, wants to achieve rebirth in a realm in which he or she has the ability to help sentient beings? Isn't that the opposite of wanting to attain ultimate nirvana, but instead wanting to renounce it until all sentient beings are saved? So this also is a common misconception, thinking that bodhisattvas do not attain awakening because they want to stay in samsara to benefit sentient beings. It's not that bodhisattvas don't attain awakening, because clearly, as a fully awakened Buddha, one can be of greater benefit to sentient beings than one can be as a bodhisattva. So bodhisattvas definitely want to attain Buddhahood, and they want to attain Buddhahood as quickly as possible, because their mind stream continues on after they attain Buddhahood and now is completely purified, and so they can do so much more to be of great benefit to sentient beings. Bodhisattvas, their level of compassion is so great that they think, if it would benefit sentient beings more for me not to attain an awakening, I'm happy to stay in samsara, which is like a hellhole. I'm happy to stay here to benefit sentient beings. And they think like that because their compassion is so great that they would be willing to give up their own awakening to stay and benefit sentient beings. But when they actually think about it and check, they see that it would be much better for sentient beings if they attain full awakening as quickly as possible. So they go ahead and do that, and then they can manifest many, many different kinds of bodies throughout the different realms of samsara and benefit sentient beings in that way.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when people know that they're very ill, they get a huge to-do list. of things they have to do in order to stay alive a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't know if you could comment on the dedication that that takes to stay alive a little bit longer and how that works out the other goals.
Yeah, so you're saying that sometimes when people know they're terminal, they develop a huge to-do list of all these different things that they're going to try in order to...
Well, even the doctor would give it to them.
Yeah, yeah. All these different things they could do to eke out a little bit more time. Okay. And so sometimes the doctors say, you know, you could have this treatment, you can have that treatment, you can have the other treatment. Sometimes they want to go to this country to be treated by this kind of thing that isn't allowed in their own country, or go to that because there's this kind of prayer, sort of all different sorts of things going around the world to try and get something that will cure them, yeah, or maybe give them a little bit more time. I think sometimes, I mean, it seems to me that that comes from a definite fear of death. Yeah, it's like, I've got to do everything I can to stay alive. And, you know, I can see that if you're a Dharma practitioner, it makes some sense to try and stay alive as long as you can to practice. If you're an ordinary person, you know, doing that, you know, staying alive is good, it's better than dying, but you're, you know, running around in circles trying to stay alive longer. And I wonder in those situations if it might not be better to develop a spiritual practice and let that spiritual practice help your mind settle down so that you can accept your death and plan for your death instead of frantically running around trying all sorts of things to stay alive. But, you know, it's going to depend on the person, isn't it?
Sometimes people do find cures that way, though.
Yeah, sometimes people do find cures that way.
So, a few questions from online. For people who have lost the ability to think, like they have dementia or Alzheimer's, how do we help with their passing?
Well, you, again, remind them of their good qualities. You say the same things. Whether they understand or not, you can't control, but you're reminding them of good things. You chant mantras, you recite sutras, say things, you know, so that they can get good imprints on their mind. Try and keep them calm. Don't have people in the room who are crying and carrying on. No, go ahead.
Oh, why is it some people have a strong instinct that death is coming? Is that imaginary?
I don't know. Maybe they have some feeling inside their body that their body is losing energy. I don't know.
And regarding the Bodhisattva question, what about Siddhigarbha Bodhisattva who renounced Buddhahood until all hells are empty?
I think my take on it is that Siddhigarbha still attained Buddhahood, because that would help him empty all the hell realms faster. I think they talk that way about bodhisattvas as a way of emphasizing their great compassion.
Mm-hmm. Could you clarify just a little the Mahayana view on what we can do for people after they've passed? I mean, there's 49 days where the conscious is like still between bodies. And does the imprint of death karmically have more a choice on their next body than like the karma that they may have created in another lifetime?
I said that last part again.
Like, is the karma that's like of the imprint on their mind, like before they die, more important than the karma that they've had in other lives?
It depends which, you know, is the karma that they create before they die going to be more important than the karma they've created in other lives? You know, we have so many different karmas on our mind, we don't know which karma is actually going to ripen. So it's good to create as much virtuous karma as possible with whatever time we have left. Yeah. And we can't say what is going to be stronger at the time of death. Although certainly, actions done with a very strong intention are going to be stronger. So, you know, the more we can create virtue with a strong intention, actions done repeatedly are going to be stronger. So the more we can repeatedly do actions, okay, this kind of thing. I always find it so interesting when I speak on death, the questions people ask me afterwards. Yeah, it's all about how do I help somebody else die? Yeah? I find it fascinating the questions people ask after a talk on death. Nobody asks, nobody says, I'm kind of afraid of dying, you know. How do I practice? To which I would respond, why have I been teaching this whole thing from the beginning?
That's what he asks.
So you know the answer, that's why you don't ask the question. Okay. Yeah. It's like, what do you do when you're dying? I mean, the Buddha, when we have a text like this, they are telling us how they think. And they are telling us what to meditate on to have the same kind of realizations as they have. Yeah. So it's not like when I die, I'm going to forget all this and practice something else. Yeah. But people hardly ever ask that question. It's always about how do I help somebody else who's dying.
Mm-hmm. Those of us who grew up in strong Christian households, I sometimes wonder about when it comes time for me to pass on, if I'm going to be inundated in my mind with fears of, think about that, burning in hell for the rest of eternity. And I wonder about my strength of being able to deal with that.
Yeah. Okay. This is a good question. So you've been brought up in a strong Christian household where you were inculcated from the time you were a kid with heaven and hell and sin and all this stuff. And then at the time of death, your concern is that going to come up? And that kind of fear, and then...
Well, it comes up for me, you know, occasionally.
Yeah, it comes up even when you're alive. So this is the value of really thinking clearly about what you believe and what views you hold to. Because that thing about hell and, you know, and sin and all that, that was some previous conditioning you got when you were a kid. And to really go into it and look at it and say, you know, that is not true. What they taught me, when I use reasoning, when I look at things clearly, what they taught me was not true. Yeah. I don't need to be afraid of God punishing me and sending me to hell. Yeah. Nobody is going to punish me and send me to hell. Okay. I need to be concerned with the actions I do. And so I need to purify my negative karma and create virtue and abandon non-virtue as much as possible. Yeah. But I don't need to worry about somebody else sending me to hell because that's a total impossibility. Yeah. And so you keep reminding yourself of that. Remind yourself of the Buddhist worldview and what you believe now, and then use your reasoning to again and again prove to yourself that, you know, what they filled your mind with when you were a kid is simply not true. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, when we were little kids, adults may have told us about the boogeyman, and we may have been afraid of the boogeyman. And then we got older, and then we realized there's no boogeyman. And we stopped being afraid of the boogeyman. So in the same way, you know, we may have been taught something that's similar. I mean, teaching that somebody's going to send you to hell where you're going to burn forever, that's similar to telling a kid there's the boogeyman. Yeah. And so, okay, I'm older now, I know that that's not something that is literally true.
I'm just shocked how much it still comes up. I mean, I'm with you. It's just,
yeah.
The fact that it still pops up.
Yeah. So this kind of conditioning, yeah, it does pop up. And that's why it's good. Every time it does, then you go back and you remind yourself of, you know, what your worldview is. Yeah. And if fear ever arises like that, just visualize the Buddha and take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha and imagine light and nectar coming from the Buddha into you and think that all those wrong views are getting completely dispersed.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest how I feel. Because they talk about the hell, the hot hell, and the cold hell. So it does in Buddhism too. Mm-hmm. Because there is hell. Mm-hmm. And I found that the hell in Buddhism is worse than. Because my thoughts, every action that I do, being impatient, being judgmental, that brings me straight to hell in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. It's very bad karma. In Catholicism, it's not that bad.
It's still bad.
It's pretty bad. Anyway, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. So I found that Buddhism is way more angrier.
I don't think so. I don't know. The question was, you know, is. According to Buddhist teachings, is it easier to get to hell than according to Christian teachings? I don't think so. You know, because the actions, it has to be a complete action where you identify, you know, what you're going to do, what the person is, you have a bad intention, you carry out the motivation, you carry out the action, you do the action, you rejoice at it at the end of it, you never have any regret. Yeah. If you look at your life, okay, sometimes you lose your temper or whatever, but it's not as serious as killing somebody or doing something really horrible. And afterwards, you look at it and you regret it. Yeah, and just the fact of regretting and doing purification practices, that impedes the karma from ripening. Okay, so I'm not saying that we all, you know, should think, oh, I'm not going to the lower realms, those are for other people. We'll talk about this actually the next session, so I won't go into it a lot now. You know, to be aware of the possibility of being born in the lower realms. But also not to get ourselves so freaked out about it that we can't think clearly. Okay, but I'll talk about this next time, okay? Yeah?
Just a comment from someone online who says, I'm not afraid of death, I'm afraid of the pain that comes with the different certain types of death.
Yeah. Okay, so saying I'm not afraid of death, check up. And, yeah, sometimes we think, oh, well, I'm not afraid of death. Yeah, but then sometimes, you know, like when you wake up in the morning and your mind is kind of subtle or something, if you think, I could die, then watch what your mind does. Then you realize, oh, there's some fear of death here. But more than that, this person is saying, I'm afraid of the pain that comes, okay, with certain kinds of death. And so there, the thing is, how do you practice Dharma with pain? So I think the taking and giving meditation there is a really excellent way. Yeah? Or meditating on emptiness, see the emptiness of the pain, of the person experiencing the pain, and so on. Okay? This will be the last question.
I'm not so sure. Something, but when Vishuddhanavam died, he found it very important that the picture of his teachers close by him. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wondered how important the role of a teacher is in the process of dying.
Mm, Okay. So when Geshe Thupten Nalan died, he found it very helpful. He really wanted the picture of his teacher close to him, you know, so how important is the role of the teacher when you're dying? I know for myself, when I die, I want to have my teacher's pictures close to me, because looking at my teacher's pictures will remind me of the Dharma that they taught me, and keeping that Dharma in my mind is what will help me when I die. Yeah. So, and also just, you know, sometimes thinking about your teacher can draw you closer to refuge, draw you closer to emptiness. If you solidify your teacher and you're holding on to your teacher as some kind of inherently existent personality, that is not going to help. But if, you know, seeing your teacher helps remind you of emptiness or bodhicitta, and very helpful at the time of death. Okay. So, we'll stop for this evening. Try and do this meditation. And remember, at the end of the meditation, always think, how, knowing what I know from about the death is definite and the time is indefinite and the Dharma is the only thing that matters when I die. How is that going to change my priorities? How will that understanding, how do I want it to affect my life so that I can really live a very vital, meaningful life? Okay, so always come back to that at the end of the meditation.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain, pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west, Lord.